This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Women have long known that sexual harassment is a problem, but it took accusations against Hollywood movie mogul Harvey Weinstein for the dam to break. One woman stepped forward, and then others joined her in accusing Weinstein of sexual harassment and assault. These women confirmed what had long been rumored in Tinseltown. Now, that all began about a month ago. Since then, others have been similarly accused, including the head of news at NPR. He resigned. Weinstein lost control of his company and may face criminal charges, and the same is now true for actor Kevin Spacey. Spacey was accused of molesting a then-teenage actor, Anthony Rapp. In the days that followed, eight others came forward with similar stories. Production was immediately shut down on Spacey's successful Netflix show, House of Cards. And just yesterday, a former Boston TV news anchor accused Spacey of sexually assaulting her 19-year-old son. Now, let me caution that these are allegations. Spacey has said he doesn't remember the first incident and has yet to comment on the latest allegation, though he has said he is seeking treatment, and the same is true of Harvey Weinstein. Those accusations, along with the acceleration of the social media campaign Me Too, seem to have changed our attitude about something society has long ignored. Some are asking, is this the turning point? Despite all the human resources handbooks that have told those in power that sexual harassment is wrong, will this finally put an end to this behavior? We spend the hour talking about that with someone who deals with HR issues all the time. That's Kenny Colbert, president of the Employers Association. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
Also with us, Becky Lindahl, an attorney and partner with Catton, Muchin, Rosenman, and a board member of Safe Alliance. Was I even close?
You got it.
I got it. Thank you for being back with us as well. Both are in our Spirit Square studio, and with us by phone is Kim Churches, CEO of the American Association of University Women. Thank you for joining us too, Kim.
Good morning.
Good morning. Okay, so before allegations against Harvey Weinstein were made public, we all watched the fall of Roger Ailes, the late Roger Ailes, the then CEO of Fox News, then Bill O'Reilly from Fox News, both forced out over allegations of sexual harassment. It was later revealed that O'Reilly had paid millions, tens of millions of dollars to keep things quiet. We've had the famous Hollywood Access Hollywood tape that revealed that President Trump had some things to say about aggressions against women. Whether they are true or not, I don't know, but he made the allegations that they were. And then Weinstein's information came out and resulted in a cascade of accusations by others and against others. What was it about the Harvey Weinstein situation that seemed to have flipped a switch in how we, particularly women, regard and treat allegations of sexual harassment? I'm not sure which one of you wants to take that. You're the attorney here. Why did Harvey Weinstein open the floodgates, Becky?
That's a difficult question. I think probably because, and this is not a legal opinion. I mean, the Harvey Weinstein issue is a little bit different than some of the legal issues that we deal with, because there wasn't necessarily an employment relationship between these women and Mr. Weinstein. But my guess would be that the prominence of these women and their sort of baked-in credibility helped other women come forward.
Well, there wasn't an employment relationship necessarily with all of them, but he was a major force.
Correct.
In Hollywood, he could probably control your fate in one way or the other. And maybe you weren't doing a movie for him at that moment, but if you wanted to do a movie for him or one of his very powerful friends, perhaps the pressure was there to play ball. Is that illegal? It's immoral, but is it illegal?
In terms of if you're looking at employment claims, if they're not his employee, there would be no liability under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is where sexual harassment becomes actionable in a civil legal sense. But in terms of other legal remedies, if he's committing, you know, sexual battery or inflicting emotional distress upon these women, or if he's interfering with their potential business contractual relationships, then there could be some civil tort liability against him. It would have been extraordinarily brave of these women to file a lawsuit like that You know, these allegations go back quite a long time, and as you mentioned, it's sort of the groundswell of support is relatively recent.
Right.
So filing a lawsuit like that would have been brave, both that it would have gotten a lot of publicity, but also when you file a civil lawsuit, you open yourself up to discovery, where you can be deposed. And think we've seen with Donald Trump and other famous people where deposition tapes and videos leak out. So those sorts of things could expose women to a lot more publicity and attention than they might otherwise want.
So we're going to talk about how this has been happening historically in the workplace of people in power, and sometimes not always people in power, just coworkers, but mainly people in power. And there are HR regulations that or guidelines in most situations that have guided that now for years, Kenny Colbert. But when you're Harvey Weinstein and you run your own company, you are the company. You're the president, the CEO, you founded it, etc. Do HR regulations apply? I mean, he had a contract that talked about there's a morals clause, but do HR regulations apply when you're the head guy? You own it. It's your company.
Well, he had to report to a board of directors, mm-hmm. and so they held him accountable for his actions. But let's go back to what you were talking about a second ago. All of these names that you mentioned were people of power. In a lot of cases, when you have sexual harassment incidents, it's a person of power in having influence over others. Mm-hmm. Harvey Weinstein's background has been known for years and years, but it took one person of prominence, one famous actress, to come forward, and then everybody jumped on the bandwagon there. So I think that you're going to see more and more cases like this exposed. This Me Too effort now is going to give women the power to come forward. In some cases, it's going to have the men the power to come forward because it can be reverse harassment as well. So I think you're going to see more cases like this come out. The Bill O'Reillys, the Harvey Weinsteins are going to be more and more prominent.
So, Kim, for every high-profile person like a Harvey Weinstein, and in the case of Kevin Spacey, every prominent person who is suspected or accused of this behavior or found definitively guilty of it, there are how many unknown people who we would never, just ordinary people in walks of life, in businesses around the country, are there who might be also equally guilty of this behavior?
So that's a terrific segue here. I would say, you know, back to what Becky was talking about on in terms of why the floodgates opened up. You know, I think following the election, the Women's March, women really started talking to one another in different ways. And the fact that this is largely coming up out of the entertainment and media industries, prominent faces that we see, you know, in our buzz feeds here on stations like this, read on top of the fold of our newspapers and magazines, that prominence level and allowing women to start to feel that they're part of a network that can help them to raise their voices into a chorus. And frankly, women are angry. They're tired of this behavior in every single industry. It doesn't matter if you're in manufacturing, if you're in a K-12 school, if you're on a university campus, or if you're in a Fortune 100 corporation. This is systemic culturally, and women now are saying enough. And that's what hashtag MeToo is all about.
So where was that anger when the Access Hollywood tape was revealed? Where was that anger when it was revealed that then-candidate Trump was able to walk into dressing rooms at the pageants that he used to sponsor and be confronting women who were scantily clad because it was a dressing room, for crying out loud? Where was the anger there?
I would say there's a couple things on that, and some of it just gets into our political nature, which is not the subject of our show today.
No.
But what occurred last year, there will be multiple policy experts and pundits reframing what happened in the 2016 election from here until well into the future. Some of that was there was so much presumption that Hillary Clinton would win the general election in November, and so it was a little bit poo-pooed, perhaps. Where the anger should have been placed more abundantly around the Access Hollywood tape. So, you know, if that were to come out today, I would gather that it would gather more storm and more action than what we saw occur last year. But that's my opinion on it. I think that's more of a political question of where we were in America on both sides of the coin in leading up to the election.
Are these instances of harassment and sometimes sexual aggression, where it's not wanted, are these just instances of the exercise of powerful people exercising their power over others? Is it are these instances of where people are simply oblivious to how wrong this behavior is? Is it simply because I'm so irresistible that you must want me? What is it? What drives it? I'm not sure who to ask that, because we need a psychologist here for that. But seriously, what drives it?
I don't know that any of us are qualified to answer that question. I think maybe all of the above. It's hard to imagine that people could be oblivious at this point to, you know, the consequences and the wrongful nature of unwanted sexual contact.
This has been going on forever.
Oh, of course.
Forever. So let's go back to Mad Men. Let's go back.
I didn't watch it.
You're the one.
I'm the one.
Only one. Well, it was the 19. Let me
frame it. I'm familiar with the plot.
It was the 1960s. Women were just coming into the workforce en masse, and usually they were in low-level jobs, secretaries, etc. And they were, that show pointed out, they were the object of a lot of aggression by men, particularly sexual aggression. They were playthings. Was that because the men knew that what they were doing was immoral or unwanted or wrong? Or was it simply because, you know, I'm making a lot of money here, I'm good looking, or even if I'm not good looking, I have a corner office, I have a suit, you must want me.
I think a lot of it was probably.
Go ahead. Mike, I really believe this gets to just the simple fact that women have not been treated as equals ever in the workplace, truly. This is not about even the Mad Men era, which is when we really saw the floodgates again open and women really started joining the workforce in a variety of different roles. But women are not treated even today in 2017 as equals in the workplace. And so, therefore, we've been treated in many cases like second-class citizens. So it becomes approved behavior or just known knowns. And what's interesting is, even when men feel uncomfortable around the water cooler when they hear their colleagues saying disparaging things about women that might just be simply sexism, they don't naturally call it out always, because it's just kind of the culture of where we are in the workplace. So this has been systemic for too long, and this is frankly just about women's rights to be treated with respect in the workplace just as men are.
So, Kenny, you're an HR expert and you deal with companies all the time about their HR needs. When companies began to add this to their guidelines, because it wasn't always there, I'm sure.
Right.
Was this a shock to a lot of male managers that this was a problem?
It was to some companies. You know, we first started hearing about sexual harassment cases in the late 70s and early 80s, and it gained its prominence. And some people just wouldn't accept the fact that this is not right. Kim brought up a key word, culture. This has been ingrained in culture for years and years and years in the workplace. And so in the late 80s, when laws were really being enforced, it came about 1964, but it was the 80s before we really saw some major court cases related to this. It was a shock to a lot of people. And we still have hard-headed knuckleheads in the workplace that won't follow the guidelines and won't believe that. Fortunately, though, we rarely see in the workplace the Harvey Weinstein type things where you're the quid pro quo. You go to bed with me or you lose your job. We generally see more of the hostile work environment, the light gray activities.
But do you see more of you go to bed with me or you don't get this promotion, you don't get this raise, you'll not advance in the company?
Yeah. Again, that's the true position of power. And fortunately, on a day-to-day basis in the workplace, we don't see as much of that. We see more of the jokes, the emails, the comments, the cartoons, the pictures and things like this, and they are repeated, and then it becomes illegal.
For people who don't believe that this goes on, the EEOC reports that 70% of women never report harassment. We'll talk about that when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and PNC Wealth Management. The PNC team strives to provide insights that help customers make the most of their wealth. More information from Jennifer Green at 704-686-2129. And David Weekly Homes, featuring Energy Saver Homes in its new Matthews communities, Eden Hall and Fullwood Station. Details and available inventory at davidweeklyhomes.com and Equal Housing Opportunity. Well, tomorrow it's the weekly news roundup here on Charlotte Talks. Vi Lyles wins handily as mayor of Charlotte. Charlotte City Council sports new members, under 40, many of them at least. And the school bonds pass easily. Former Governor Pat McCrory says he lays the blame off for last year's gubernatorial loss, but does not close the door for a future run. And the Texas church shootings last Sunday have Charlotte churches evaluating their own security measures. Our roundtable of reporters talks about those stories and more tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Asper. Coming up on the next On Point, domestic violence and mass shootings. We'll look at the link in Sutherland Springs, Texas, and beyond. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point coming up at 10, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking today about sexual harassment in the workplace, allegations, and the actual act of harassing somebody sexually, with Kenny Colbert, who's the president of the Employers Association. They deal with how many different organizations?
950.
Lord. With HR problems. Becky Lindahl is a partner at Katten Mushin Rosenman and a board member of Safe Alliance. They're both in our studio. Kim Churches joins us by phone. She's the CEO of the American Association of University Women. Prior to the Harvey Weinstein allegations, which literally opened the floodgates on women coming forward to say, this has happened, it's been happening to me, it's happened to my friends, it's been happening for years, and that's it, enough already. But prior to that, 70% of women never reported harassment. In fact, the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, says that although 30% of the 91,500 complaints it received in 2016 included an accusation of sex-based workplace harassment, they estimate that three-fourths of people who are sexually harassed on the job don't tell anyone, and some estimate the number is as high as 88%. Why? It's 2017, and this survey was taken in 2016. Why?
So, Mike, I would say, really, this is about a fear of retribution. Frankly, too many women are afraid that they're going to lose not just today's paycheck, but career progression if there is that power dynamic present. So fear holds people back. I can say, you know, I've worked in nonprofits, in schools, in for-profits, in the public sector throughout my career. I've never met a woman who hasn't been harassed at some level, and 99% of them never say anything to anyone out of that fear.
Is this a male-female thing? I mean, we're different people. We're different animals, men and women. Is that part of it? Or is it simply that men have been in control for so long and exercise control over others in different ways depending on your gender?
I would say, look, cultures are hard to change. Nobody likes the word change. Everybody thinks they want change until you actually start moving. And so certainly men have been in control of our major sectors and major industries. Just look at the S&P, look at the Fortune 500 and the percentage of women in leadership, elected officials, appointed officials, heads of nonprofits, et cetera. It's all males by a long shot, and so in very small percentages of women. So when you start to get into that change and women start moving into greater roles, which we're seeing more and more, including on Tuesday in the latest elections, that's great, but it does start to change things. And I think that's why there's that idea that we can be a chorus together coming forward. But frankly, are men and women different? Look, I'm a humanist more than I am a feminist, and that's because I believe all of us as human beings deserve equal rights. So are men and women different? I think men also suffer from harassment, from bad behavior, from inappropriate comments, and from assault. But overwhelmingly, the numbers show that women, women are victims more.
So your organization, the American Association of University Women, has been advocating for years for equity for women and girls. Does it shock you, though, after decades of women being in the workplace and increasing in numbers in the workplace and climbing up the ladder, although that climb has been very slow and, in fact, some would say it has stalled, after decades of that, after decades of more women than men graduating from college, does it shock you that this still exists, this problem?
It absolutely does not shock me, because this is not about passing a law in our legislatures. This is about systemic cultural change. And so while laws and policies protect us, in many cases in corporations or in businesses or nonprofits or the media or what have you, those policies and those value statements that every organization we all know and love have up on their walls and in their employee handbook sometimes can merely be rhetoric, beautiful language on paper, and not necessarily put to practice. And I think that's really what we need to be focusing on now is implementation of this, of ongoing trainings, of ensuring that employees understand their rights. And so, no, none of this has shocked me, because we've seen this story way too many times. This organization I represent has been at it since 1881. Certainly, we won the battle to ensure that women could pursue any educational degree they wanted, which is great. It doesn't mean we've achieved all of the other leadership gaps and economic security that women deserve just as much as men.
It's interesting to me that this floodgates opened in Hollywood, of all places, because the casting couch is, I mean, it's been going on forever since the beginning of the movie business, evidently, and it's well known. They've made movies about the casting couch, for crying out loud. So everybody knew that it existed, and yet it's coming from that industry. Kim says that the mantra should be, if you see something, say something, just like terrorism. If you witness sexual harassment, you should say it. Other experts say that in order to put an end to all of this in the workplace, not only do you have to say something, but you also have to have strong anti-harassment policies in place with real consequences for harassers. And she just said, Kim just said that we have to enforce these and we have to let people know what their rights are in the workplace. Is that being done? Just because something's in the HR manual, does that mean that the company's really behind it? Does it mean that the employees know that it's there? Does it mean that the employees feel secure in exercising the rights that the handbook outlines? Yeah.
I think a number of companies do a great job with their handbook, but it needs to go further than that. Companies need to have a culture where reporting is – you're free of any adverse action if you report something like this. You need to do annual training or biannual training, so you need to have someone come in and talk about sexual harassment.
Except I read yesterday that one expert said that the annual meeting about that is a waste of time because people aren't going to retain it and it doesn't have any impact.
I think it depends upon who delivers the training, and the methodology of the training is a big thing. So, yeah, if you have someone up there with a boring session for 30 minutes and people feel like they have to go to it, you're just checking the block, it's not going to go anywhere. But if it's meaningful exercises and engagement, sexual harassment training can be a good experience.
How much of the silence, Becky, about this, because until Weinstein, we didn't really hear all that much about that. How much of the silence is because people did not come forward for whatever reason, or they did? And they were shut up by being paid off, like Bill O'Reilly.
Well, we'll never know exactly how much of that happened, because these women, what we're hearing is they signed non-disclosure agreements, which are enforceable, that don't allow these women to speak publicly about what happened to them. And because if they do, there would be consequences tied to that potentially. I mean, most likely the consequence would be having to pay back whatever the monetary payment was that was tied with that agreement. There is some push in some states to enact some legislation to make those types of non-disclosure agreements unenforceable as a matter of public policy. But as far as I know, sitting here today, that hasn't gotten a lot of traction. So I think the answer is, we'll never know, because these women most likely have very significant motivation to stick to the terms of whatever non-disclosure agreement that they signed. And certainly whatever attorney was advising Mr. O'Reilly or whoever about this non-disclosure agreement would have tied some pretty significant penalties to breaching it.
I think another reason it's not reported as much is a lot of the females will say, nobody will believe me.
Right.
These are private conversations. You look where Harvey Weinstein would write somebody up to a hotel room, et cetera, and it was he and the actress there, no witnesses to it. You've got a very powerful person there. But sooner or later, as people start talking, like happened with the Harvey Weinstein, it's one person let it out in public, another person jumped on the bandwagon and say, and that's the same thing in the workplace. A lot of people say, my supervisor harassed me behind closed doors. There were no witnesses. Nobody will believe that I'm doing that.
And another,
I have to jump in here because it occurred to me when Harvey Weinstein, his modus operandi seemed to have been inviting women up to his hotel room or wherever, and then urging them to have some sort of sexual congress with him. Why would a woman go up to a hotel room of a very powerful guy? Why would they do, particularly a guy with a reputation? Whether it's why? Why would you do that?
Look, Mike, in that industry, it's so common because they're out on the road all the time that meetings can take places in hotels, particularly it could be in the L.A. area, it could be in New York. It could
downstairs
be
in the lobby, in the bar, in the restaurant, sure. But why the hotel room?
Agreed, but they're usually lavish suites, so they're large and they have separate rooms. It's not, your typical Marriott courtyard, so they're going to have a little bit more space. But it's also the nature of that industry to ensure quiet, off-the-record conversations about your career. And for many women, a meeting with somebody who's as powerful as a Harvey Weinstein means access to potential great roles. And there are many, many famous actresses, some of whom are still deciding to be a little mute on this, like Uma Thurman's comments this week, that she's still too angry to really express her full views on this subject, because this is not just a Harvey Weinstein issue. This is part of that industry in
right.
general and how they operate.
I think it's a gamble that a lot of people are taking and said, hey, could this be my trip to an Oscar?
Yep.
And maybe I'll be the one person that he doesn't harass, even though he has a reputation of doing it.
So Jennifer on Facebook writes, I guarantee that the percentage of women who faced harassment is closer to 99%. Kate on Facebook, fear of repercussions and being blacklisted from opportunities should be flipped around to the harasser. The tide seems to be turning as of late, and it's about time. Let's get some definitions, because maybe there's some guys out there who just don't know. What constitutes harassment? In the HR playbook, what constitutes harassment?
There are two types. Obviously, you've got quid pro quo, which this for that. Go to bed with me or you lose your job. Go to bed with me and I'll give you a promotion, et cetera. And that's the worst form. You're guilty the first time it happens. And as we were talking during the break, it's rare that we see that. What we typically see is what's called a hostile work environment, where something is a light gray incident, and it's generally repeated over a regular basis.
Give me an example. I don't know what that is.
Just dirty talk in the workplace. It could be racy emails. It could be suggestive comments to a coworker, those type things.
Okay.
And they're generally repeated over a period of time. And in many of these cases, the receiver or the victim does not say anything, does not say no. Or if they do say no and it continues, it's certainly illegal at that point. But a lot of times the victim just doesn't say anything, so the harasser feels it's a green light to proceed with those things, even though it's causing an uncomfortable work environment.
But if you don't say anything, you don't know that you're causing. If nobody's talking back to you saying, don't say those things to me, I don't like that, how do you know you're causing discomfort? Maybe you think that person is enjoying it. Maybe you think there's a spark there that needs to be explored.
Hopefully this Me Too is going to bring that out. But in many cases, not saying anything means you don't like it.
Really?
But the more aggressive approach is to say, I don't like that. Stop. Don't do that in my presence.
So,
and hopefully we'll hear more of that now.
Well, the difficulty, too, is that you could be, you know, if you're in a workplace with a bullpen type open work environment and there are jokes being exchanged between two employees that – you know, the recipient employee, those dirty jokes are not unwanted, which is how you get to a hostile work environment. But the people sitting around them don't want to hear that.
So legally, is the definition different from what Kenny just described?
No, Kenny described it accurately. And I agree with Kenny that we don't see the quid pro quo very often, which is –
it's fortunate.
Which is fortunate because that would be bad news for an employer to hear that there was quid pro quo going on in their workplace. It is more often the dirty jokes over email, unwanted touching, and not in the Harvey Weinstein type, but like, you know, touching a shoulder, touching a back, and dirty jokes. That's sort of,
you know, and even in the workplace, in some cases, this start off as a mutual arrangement where both parties enjoy it, and then at some point along the way, somebody crosses the line, and it becomes a hostile environment at that point.
You know, I want to add in one thing here, though, because on the quid pro quo, there's the obvious clear statement of do this or you're fired, or do this and you'll get promoted. But what if it's implicit and it's, you know, that happens all too often, where too many victims of this type of just merely light gray sexist commentary, or much more elaborate dark charcoal gray harassment to black harassment in color scope here. It could just be implied quid pro quo. And that, again, I think ensures that fear of victims coming forward.
According to ABC News, Harvey Weinstein acknowledged inappropriate behavior but unequivocally denied any allegations of non-consensual sex. That was early on in all of this. That may have changed. I don't know. What would constitute inappropriate behavior? What kind of things? Is it just talk? Is it walking up to somebody and giving them a back massage at their desk? What is it?
I think it's good advice to just not touch your colleagues. I think that's a good that's good advice. Just no touching in the workplace. But I mean, I think it depends a little bit on the culture of the company, of course, within the confines of what Title VII considers to be, you know, hostile work environment. But you know, certainly, I think email is where most people get themselves into the most trouble with inappropriate emails. And then, you know, another way that people can get themselves into trouble at work is if there's a consensual sexual relationship that at some point crosses the line into quid pro quo or an unwanted.
And what if there is a consensual sexual relationship and others in the office know that this is going on and believe that because the boss is having some sort of relationship with person X, I did not get the raise, I did not get the promotion. Is that harassment?
Well, that's a source of potential Title VII liability. So if you have two employees who are engaged in a consensual sexual relationship and the other employees around them think, well, he or she is getting the promotion because they're sleeping with the boss and I didn't get it, that could be a source of either quid pro quo or hostile work environment liability.
Is it possible that some people who indulge in this activity don't know that they're doing it? And I asked that question because yesterday, in reading for this, I discovered that some people believe that compliments to colleagues are off limits. You can say, you can't say, wow, nice sweater, or you really look nice today. That would be harassment. That's what some believe.
I'm sure that there are people who have the subjective belief that that would be harassment. The law does put some threshold around that in addition to being unwanted, it has to rise to a certain level of objective sort of offensiveness. So I would say probably prefacing any compliment to a colleague with wow would be a bad idea. I think that goes both ways.
I'm in trouble. Wow.
That goes both ways, Mike. Some people are afraid to give the compliment because they think it's harassment. But then you have someone who's on the receiving end that thinks every time they receive a compliment that it is harassment,
right,
as well. So it's kind of a double-edged sword there.
Wow. There you go. I said it again. As women have come to power in certain situations, is there any empirical or even anecdotal evidence that they too have engaged in sexual harassment in the opposite direction? Because suddenly they have the keys,
yes,
to the kingdom.
I mean, you look at the EEOC statistics, there's a very small percentage of cases where the female was the harasser. No doubt about it, it's predominantly male, but there are cases of female.
And does that get reported less often because the man would be embarrassed to report that?
It just doesn't – well, probably – I jokingly say probably a lot of men would be happy for it to happen in the workplace.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about African-American women and the harassment they have historically faced. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NC Warren, presenting Clean Path 2025, a strategy to slow climate change, save money, and create jobs with local solar power and battery storage. NCWarren.org. And People's Bank, committed to turning vision into reality by listening, encouraging, and believing in possibilities. People's Bank. Be exceptional. PeoplesBankNC.com. Member FDIC. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, it's On Point. Jane Clayson is in for Tom Ashbrook, and she continues talking about the aftermath of the shooting in Texas over the weekend with a discussion about domestic violence and mass shootings. A panel joins Jane to talk about the link between the two in Sutherland Springs and beyond. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. We will continue to talk about the impact, the fallout from Harvey Weinstein and other sexual harassment allegations around the world when we come back. Stay with us.
Hey, y'all, this is Tommy Tomlinson. I'm the host of a new podcast through WFAE called Southbound. I'll be talking to notable Southerners of all kinds, athletes and artists, preachers and politicians, about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. Look for Southbound on WFAE.org, the WFAE app, on iTunes, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about sexual harassment in the workplace with Kenny Colbert, president of the Employers Association, Becky Lindell, partner at Kattenmuschen Rosenman and a board member of Safe Alliance, and Kim Churches, the CEO of American Association of University Women. And although, as we have discussed, men are on occasion the victims of sexual assault, women have historically borne the brunt of these transgressions. And as they have on so many other fronts, African-American women may have had to shoulder an out, not in the may have, they definitely have had to shoulder an outsized portion of that burden. And here to talk about that is Nicole Buchanan, Associate Professor of Psychology at Michigan State University. Nicole, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about how women of color are affected by harassment, talk to me about the psychology of the harasser. I asked a question a few minutes ago that required a psychologist. You are one, so at last you've arrived. It's been pointed out by more than a handful of comedians that in many of these high-profile cases, the accused abusers are not attractive at all, but they are powerful. So is this purely power? I'm making these comments to you. I'm trying to get you to have some kind of a relationship with me because I'm powerful, or because you must think that I am irresistibly attractive, or because I don't know I'm being stupid. What's the psychology behind this?
Well, there's often the assumption that individuals are misguided in their flirting. They think the person is attractive, and that's why they're engaging the behavior. But what we know is sexual harassment in the workplace is often about things like power, gender policing, trying to establish dominance over other people in the workplace, and it's very rarely about sexual interest in that individual.
Hmm. African-American women have had to deal with this since slavery. You say that experts who generally investigate harassment have been disturbingly silent about issues facing women of color. And you know this because you've studied it and you published a paper on it. So why are investigators silent about issues that women of color have had to deal with in the workplace?
As a field, I think part of the problem is that we don't have many researchers of color doing this work. And when those individuals are absent, those kinds of questions often are not asked. But the work that has been done has been very consistent in demonstrating that women of color typically have more frequent harassment. It's often more severe, more sexualized, more likely to involve being physically touched or assaulted. And they're also less likely to be believed or to have appropriate intervention when they try to get the organization to do something about it.
This is something that, including rape, that women of color have had to contend with, particularly during slavery, but in the years that followed, because they went into the workplace long before most white women did, usually as domestics, and so they were in houses, not places of business, where this could go on pretty much unnoticed. They worked as domestics. They made little money. They needed those jobs. They had zero power. And certainly they were afraid to come forward when they were being harassed. So for them, were conditions then or even now in some cases really any better than they were during the slavery?
That's an excellent question. I think it's clearly better than it was at that point in time. But the kind of images of black women from slavery to the current day really have focused on them being hypersexual, even an aggressive, sexually animalistic. And those kind of images invite sexual victimization. It dehumanizes and it presents them as nothing more than sexual beings. And the Jezebel, she's got to have it. She wants it like this. So that puts black women in additional risk.
Where does that come from, that idea?
There's a lot of evidence that this began during slavery and was used as a way of justifying the sexual assault and rape of black slaves and has continued throughout history. You can see it even currently in popular media images of black women. They still focus on particular stereotypes of black women, such as the Jezebel, where she's hypersexual, aggressive, and appreciates having sexual advances from men. So with that stereotype proliferating, even to the current day, it invites a lot of harassment.
You say that sexual harassment is perhaps the most common occupational hazard for working women, and you say that for women of color, sexual harassment is rarely, if ever, about sex or sexism. It's about race. Explain that.
When we look at the kinds of experiences black women report, and this is also true with other women of color, they rarely are purely sexual or purely gendered. Instead, they tend to infuse elements of race throughout the experience, something that I've come to call racialized sexual harassment. And you hear things like talking about her sexy black ass, or saying things about, I bet you're a slave to sex, things that conjure the historical images of sexual exploitation of black women. So the way in which race and gender become combined are very difficult for black women to separate because the experiences themselves infuse them both.
On an earlier program that we did about women in the workplace here, we learned that although black women are generally more ambitious about getting ahead in the workplace than their white female colleagues are, they have fewer opportunities to realize those dreams. And you add to that the fact that you say that women of color are more vulnerable, which leads to greater victimization. So because women have been reluctant to come forward, how have you been able to come to that conclusion?
The conclusion that it's more frequent
that they're more that they're more vulnerable, that African American women are more vulnerable if they don't come forward and report this, how do we know that?
Oh, certainly. Well, one of the ways that we know this is looking across studies. These are studies where individuals are reporting on their workplace experiences. Generally, they'll ask questions about things that have happened in the last year, so it's very recent events. And when you compare across groups, you see that the results often show that the experiences for women of color are more frequent, they're more sexualized, and they're more severe.
Are your words of advice for women of color in the workplace any different than they would be for white women or Asian women or any woman in the workplace? Aside from knowing your rights, what would your words of advice be?
I often encourage people, one, to, from the very beginning of their employment, keep documentation of the kinds of things that are happening. Often these things start small and build over time, and by the time they are ready to come forward, they may have experienced dozens of events, but they don't have documentation of those events. So keeping records of the kinds of things that are happening is important. I also do workshops teaching people, how do you respond to these lower level negative events in ways that maintain a positive relationship and hopefully get the person to understand from the very beginning that those behaviors are not welcomed.
Nicole Buchanan is an associate professor of psychology at Michigan State University who has studied women of color in the workplace with regard to sexual harassment. I'd like you to stay with us for the rest of the program if you can, Nicole. And also with us is Kim Churches, the CEO of American Association of University Women, Becky Lindell, partner with Katten Mushin Rosenman, and a board member of Safe Alliance, and Kenny Colbert, president of the Employers Association. Nicole just mentioned keeping records, document what's happening to you in the workplace. And you and others stress documenting offensive behavior is important. You say keep a diary of harassment as well as one of your own productivity so you can show, you can balance the scale, I guess. But you say don't keep it on a company computer or on a company phone. Why?
Look, this is about protecting yourself and protecting your livelihood, your paycheck and your productivity in the workplace and your future. And so I really encourage women to document it all in a safe space. And at the end of the day, all of our work, iPhones, Samsungs, our computers, et cetera, are owned by the corporation. HR, as great as they are in protecting our employees, also works for the CEO of the corporation or the company. And so unless there's a full separation of independence of HR from the company structure, almost like an ombudsman type structure, they're working for the company, and they're also making sure to protect the brand and the reputation of the company, whatever industry it's in. So I truly encourage any victim of facing any level of this harassment or assault that we've been talking about today to document everything from the dates, the times, what happened, direct quotes, but also really importantly, your own work product. That's key. And you know, there's one other thing I wanted to mention. Because I mentioned at the beginning of the show that I really don't know a woman in my professional career that hasn't experienced some level of harassment. A few years ago, I started giving out my cell phone to young women as they're entering the workforce that I met, either because they wanted to be mentored or they wanted to get a sense of where their career progression might go, whether they worked for me or in another organization or company. And just so that they know that there is a safe network of somebody that would listen to them if they had an issue and they wanted to find out, is this harassment, should I do something, and be totally safe. Just having my cell phone and knowing that there's somebody that would listen. And I really hope that some of your listeners will also consider doing that to help more women and more victims.
I want to talk, Becky, to you about this documentation thing. It's one thing to document your productivity in the workplace, because I suppose there is empirical evidence that what you're writing in your diary about your productivity can be proven, because there you've delivered on time, you've delivered a report, you've increased sales numbers, whatever that may be in your particular line of work. But when you're writing in your diary incidents where you feel you have been harassed or wronged, why is that anything more than a case of he said, she said? What makes it provable?
Well, it still may well be a case of he said, she said. If you're making contemporaneous notes as things happen, it mm-hmm. makes it a little bit easier from an evidentiary standpoint. If you get all the way to court or to trial, to have those statements be admissible, and if they're made contemporaneously, then they would have a heightened level of credibility, rather than trying to recreate something that happened to you, 6, 7, 8 years ago, because human memory is faulty. But if you get to the point where you're actually in court about this, presumably there's going to be evidence from both sides. There would probably be contemporaneous emails and things like that would come in to either corroborate or disprove.
Is it best to tell a colleague that this just happened to me 5 minutes ago? I was in the office to deliver this report, and I was sexually harassed.
It's best to follow the HR reporting policies. Telling a colleague won't necessarily protect you or give you the benefits of whatever the HR policies around harassment. And you may put that colleague in a position where some colleagues have different reporting duties to HR depending on their managerial. On their managerial level.
So this, whenever this happens, is very uncomfortable for the victim, obviously, for
sure.
Numerous reasons, and it would be uncomfortable to come forward, it would seem to me. So, Kenny, in the HR world, what is the process? When you come forward, what happens?
Well, I'm going to go back to one thing that Kim said. I think it's very important that you have the documentation, and you need dates, but not only dates, specific times, to be able to say at 9:54 on this date, I was standing in XYZ location and the following happened there. It's just going to look more impressive and more important when you have specific details. But bottom line is, if you come forward and make a complaint, HR should say, give me specifics about it, and you provide your documentation. And then you're going to go to the person who was that initiated the action, and you're going to get that person's side of the story. And as Becky said a few minutes ago, at some point in time, you may end up with a he said, she said type situation.
But if it's the CEO that you're talking about in your allegations, as you said a moment ago, HR works for the CEO.
Yeah.
Is HR going to be wise?
Well, I think in many cases, your CEO has a board of directors or someone higher up that they're reporting to, a business owner, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So in many cases, these go to the very top. And that's what's happened with Weinstein.
So despite the fact that the EEOC found through a 2003 study that 75% of employees who spoke out against workplace mistreatment faced some form of retaliation, does that would be discouraging for me to go and report this because I'm 75% face retaliation. Does that mean that these protections don't work?
Well, retaliation is itself prohibited under Title VII of the
but
Civil 75% Rights Act.
75%
hold on the law.
Does that mean it doesn't work?
I do think that the workplace protections work. I think one thing that we haven't really talked about today, though, that can a consideration as to why women don't come forward is I think women are disproportionately affected by the lack, like sort of the slog on their productivity by having to go to HR with these things. It may be that you know, there's just sort of this baseline level of – or there's some sexual harassment in the workplace that doesn't rise to the level of something that would be outrageous. And they think, well, if I go report it, I'm going to have to
– And I would think this puts everybody at a disadvantage. But, Nicole, does this put women of color at a particular disadvantage if 75% face retaliation?
Absolutely. Often they are not as embedded in the workplace in the sense of having the same level of interconnections with their coworkers. And they are often devalued. So going to HR, doing things that formalize report, not only do they not typically get as aggressive a response in trying to address the matter, it may also make them a target for not only retaliation, but even being pushed out of their job.
In 2016, the EEOC received 1,265 sexual harassment complaints in this state. 29% of all complaints were about sexual harassment. What can men do in 15 seconds or less to stop this? Just should they be
say
allies?
Something.
Say
when
something.
When they see something, they should say something.
Yeah. Okay. And that's Becky Lindell. You get the last word. Partner at Cat & Mooshin Rosenman, board member of Safe Alliance. Kim Churches joined us, the CEO of the American Association of University Women. Kenny Colbert, president of the Employers Association. They're an HR group that works with over 900 companies. And Nicole Buchanan, associate professor of psychology at Michigan State University. Thank you all for the hour.